Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. Today, Seth interviews journalist Chris Hayes, and as a special podcast bonus, we follow Chris as he rushes from Studio AG to his MSNBC studio. Then, a new edition of Late Night Chats with staffers Steve Battista and Ryan Reese. But first, a closer look.
Republicans postponed a vote on their health care bill today after trying unsuccessfully to ram it through the House. And as this is all happening, the ongoing Russia scandal continues to dog the Trump White House. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. So House Republicans were forced to delay a vote on their health care bill today after acknowledging they didn't have the votes to pass it. So what was Trump up to on this crucial afternoon that would decide the future of our nation's health care? Well, he was meeting with truckers at the White House and at one point decided to climb into the driver's seat himself. In fairness, he had just seen this bumper sticker. Now, the last 24 hours in politics have been truly mind-boggling. You've got the president doubling down on his false wiretapping claim, Republicans scrambling to cobble together a health care bill before anyone even knows what's in it, and new reports that Trump associates may have coordinated with Russia. And all of that comes on top of yesterday's news that Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign chairman, secretly worked for a Russian billionaire with a plan to greatly benefit the Putin government. The billionaire was a close Putin ally with whom Manafort eventually signed a $10 million annual contract. So Trump's campaign chairman's previous job was working to advance Vladimir Putin's agenda. That's like finding out your babysitter's previous job was baking children into pies. And if you feel overwhelmed by the constant drumbeat of scandal in this administration, you're not alone. Just check out Senator John McCain's face when he went on MSNBC yesterday to talk Trump and Russia.
There is evidence that is not circumstantial and is very much worthy of investigation. So that is what we ought to do.
With me, Arizona Senator John McCain. Well, Senator?
Congratulations, Senator. You may not know what an emoji is, but you just became one. That right there, that's an 80-year-old man who was a POW and who campaigned with Sarah Palin. If you can still shock him, you are doing some crazy-ass Now, the leaking of this latest information about the FBI probe comes on top of a stunt pulled yesterday by the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Devin Nunes, who claimed that Trump officials may have been legally surveilled during the transition. Nunes held a press conference and then ran to the White House to tell Trump before telling any of the members of his own committee. Today, Nunes apologized for not speaking to other members of his own committee first and explained what brought him to make the decision to take the information to the White House in the first place.
It's just a judgment call. I mean, you know, it was my decision. I mean, it was, there was a lot going on yesterday.
Oh, there was a lot going on yesterday? No. And for the rest of us, just so you know, you were the lot that was going on. Now, as troubling as the Russian revelations are, what the Republicans have been doing with healthcare may be just as outrageous, and it certainly will affect more Americans, because Republicans who complained for years that Obamacare was rushed through Congress have literally been rewriting the bill behind closed doors with no public input in an attempt to ram it through the House before most members of Congress, let alone most Americans, have any idea what's in it.
Republicans running against the clock as they scramble to save their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare.
They're trying to get it through in a big hurry, and it's a total mess. Tonight, they seem to be rewriting the bill, essentially.
Obama's health care bill, the Democrats' health care bill, took, I think it was about 14 months for it to pass. This is intended to get passed in just a few weeks.
We had to go with the health care first, and we're doing well. I think we're going to have some great surprises.
Because that's what you want when it comes to healthcare, surprises. Although I guess when this guy is your doctor, you're used to surprises.
Surprise, man. It turns out you had several heart attacks and I just missed it, man. I've just been really distracted since my band broke up.
Now, today, Republicans said they would postpone the vote after spending all night frantically rewriting major portions of the bill to try to win over hardline conservatives. So what did they come up with during those negotiations? The changes Republicans are talking about would strip away the essential health benefits included in Obamacare. These benefits mandate things that insurance companies must cover in all plans, including prescription drugs, pregnancy, maternity and newborn care, and hospitalization. That's right. Republicans think that your insurance plan shouldn't be required to cover hospitals. But don't worry. Every American gets one free ride on the cart that picks up your dead. Here's the problem with getting rid of essential health benefits like maternity care. If you don't require all insurance to provide them, no one will. But Republicans just don't seem to understand how this works. For example, today, a reporter asked Kansas Senator Pat Roberts how he felt about repealing the essential health benefits, and Roberts joked, "I wouldn't want to lose my mammograms." That comment outraged many people, including Democratic Congresswoman Jackie Speier, who replied, "I don't want to lose my prostate cancer screenings either." And Republicans are going to need prostate exams because they clearly pulled this bill out of their asses. And if you're wondering why Republicans would strip maternity care and mammograms from health insurance, this photo of conservatives meeting with Trump today tells you all you need to know. Look how many middle-aged white dudes there are. Get those guys some guitars and a drum set, and that's a Cialis commercial. Mustang Sally, yeah. So Republicans are radically reshaping one-fifth of the economy in a matter of hours, behind closed doors, with no public input. That is insane, cruel, and reckless. And remember, this is how Republicans reacted when they thought Obamacare, which took way longer, was being rushed through Congress.
And look at how this bill was written. Can you say it was done openly? Yeah. With transparency and accountability? Yeah. Without backroom deals and struck behind closed doors? Hidden from the people? Hell no, you can't!
And now that we've proven ourselves to be craven hypocrites, hell-bent on kicking millions of people off insurance, can you believe a word we say?
Hell no, you can't!
So Trump and GOP leaders are rushing this bill through the House against the wishes of almost every interest group and without any public input first, which may explain why this bill is massively unpopular. According to a new poll out today, only 17% of American voters approve of the proposal. And yet Trump has not only been on board with it, he's been personally involved in winning over votes. In fact, after a meeting with hardline conservatives last week, he wouldn't shut up about how many votes he'd won.
These are folks that were either a no or a maybe. All of these no's or potential no's are all yeses. These folks were no's, mostly no's. Now, every single one is a yes. 100% of the no's are yeses. Some of them were strong no's, some were just no's, and we had a couple that were mixed.
We took 12 no's or semi-no's, no yeses. We met with 12 pretty much no's. They went from all no's to all yeses.
No, there were no yeses. There were no's that became yeses. And yes, the no's, no other no's that are still no's. And yes, There are yeses that are now noes who know other noes who are now yeses. I think that you're doing very well with you. It's going very well.
In fact, Trump has apparently been strong-arming some members of Congress, reportedly telling them in private meetings that if they vote no, quote, I'm going to come after you. But I wouldn't sweat it too much. When he comes after you, it's a pretty slow lumber.
That was the slot that the Obamacare approach was to take.
Now, if taking 24 million people off health care and removing hospital care from insurance requirements sounds indefensible, it is. In fact, Republicans are so at a loss to defend their plan, they are now literally asking us to use our imaginations, as Health Secretary Tom Price did on CNN.
Imagine, if you will, a system that actually drives down costs of health coverage for individuals. Imagine, if you will, a system that actually provides patients with an array of options. Imagine a Medicaid system that actually works better for patients. So imagine, if you will, a system that actually puts patients at the center of it. So think about, imagine a system, if you will.
Imagine you have health care. But that is essentially the Republicans' pitch to voters and to their own caucus. Just imagine a great health care plan. In fact, Republicans keep insisting that this bill that they're rushing through Congress is only the first part of a three-part plan that will deal with different parts of the health care system, a plan they're referring to as the three-bucket strategy. But even hardline conservatives like Ted Cruz think that so-called third bucket will never come.
That ain't gonna happen. It's their so-called three-bucket solution, which is all the good stuff is in bucket three. Anything in bucket three, I've called bucket three the sucker's bucket.
The sucker's bucket, of course, is also Trump's favorite order from KFC. The enormity of what is happening right now can't be overstated. Republicans are trying to ram a bill that no one wants through Congress without telling Americans what's in it, even though it will kick millions off insurance. And so far, they can't get the votes for it. Surely after his terrible performance today, Trump wouldn't be tooting his own horn. This has been A Closer Look.
Hi, this is Fred Armisen, the music director of the HG Band. Did you know that Late Night with Seth Meyers has a podcast now? That's what this is. And it's released every Wednesday and Friday. Tell your friends who love Late Night that they should subscribe at iTunes.com/LateNightSeth. You'll find it. What I just said, you'll be able to find it. I believe in you.
Our guest is the Emmy-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes, which airs weeknights at 8 p.m. on MSNBC. His fascinating new book, A Colony in a Nation, is in stores tomorrow. Please welcome back to the show our friend Chris Hayes, everybody. Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. The last time you were here was the day after the election.
It sure was.
And we had some predictions on how things would go, but this is, I would say, has even run a field of that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing, I think that the day after the election that we talked about a little bit is, you know, in American politics, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. What would be the reaction? And we've seen it. I mean, it's sort of remarkable to watch this sort of mobilization happening, this fight over healthcare. It's been pretty astounding to watch what's happened in the last 2 months.
Because we talked about the speed in which the Republican Party would try to disassemble the accomplishments of the Obama administration, and it seems like what they're running up against is all of a sudden there's this sense of you maybe didn't like Obamacare, but you are more afraid of what no Obamacare is.
Yeah, and very much I think there's a respect in which a huge part of their base benefits from some of the things they want to get rid of. Mm-hmm. So the front page cover of the Charleston Gazette in West Virginia the day after the budget was budget hits West Virginia, right? Yeah. West Virginia went for Donald Trump by 40 points or something like that. The fact of the matter is West Virginia depends on things like the Appalachian Regional Council that's going to get cut. They depend on things like Medicaid expansion. So ultimately, politics is about what happens in people's lives. And if you hammer people, they're not going to be happy with it.
Especially when you promised answers and solutions without ever having laid out any of the details.
That's exactly yeah. Right. Or continuing to do the same.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's this sort of three-pronged strategy to everything is any policy question, the president says, current policy is a disaster. We're going to change the policy. Our policy is going to be great.
And you've interviewed and done a great job interviewing people who represent the Trump administration and the Republican Party. And sometimes, particularly within the Trump administration, they will just not give an answer. No matter how many times you ask it, no matter how many times you rephrase it, they can just really dig in.
They can. And I think partly there's this sort of fundamental mismatch of what he ran on and what and what they want to do and what they're actually doing, and there's no bridge between the two for them to be able to explain themselves. So when you talk to a Republican member of Congress, you just say, whatever you think about health care, defend the speed with which you're passing this bill. It's a little hard to do.
Yeah, especially since they criticized a much longer process.
A much, much longer process. And look, there were parts about that process they were worthy of criticism.
Absolutely.
But it was the case that, you know, that bill gets introduced in June or July. It gets voted on in November. We're talking less than 3 weeks from bill text to passage in the House for one-fifth of the American economy.
Yeah.
That's really fast.
That's really fast.
The fastest.
So I want to talk about this book, A Colony in a Nation. This was inspired by 2000, which convention was it?
It was 2000, yeah. It was
with 2000. The Democratic convention?
It was the Republican convention in Philadelphia.
Philadelphia, and you accidentally had weed on you.
I did. My
like somebody accidentally put it there?
Yeah. It showed up there.
Gotcha, yeah.
No, my father-in-law was a reporter in Chicago, a guy named Andy Shaw, and he was covering the convention in Philadelphia. My then-girlfriend, now-wife, and I decided, like, it'll be interesting civically to go down. And we're going through the multi-layer checkpoint, and I've got my bag. And at one point, we go through one checkpoint, I think, oh, my goodness, I got $30 worth of weed in an eyeglass case.
Uh-huh.
Which was not, I didn't normally carry around weed, but I happened to be at this moment.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah,
hi, Mom.
Yeah, exactly.
and so we go through, you know, these checkpoints. Finally, we get to one, and there's a Philly cop, and he goes through my bag. He goes through each compartment. He takes out the eyeglass case, and he shakes it, and he opens it, and he turns around. And I'm like, and I feel this panic. And I'm so panicked, and I so want to be delivered from this situation. I go up to my future father-in-law, and I say, Andy, the police just found weed in my bag. And he was like, why would you bring weed to the convention? And at that very moment, they said, sir, this is your bag. And I'm positive I'm going to grab it and get handcuffed. And I take it and I go in the building. And I thought about that moment as I was in the streets of Ferguson and in Baltimore and covering all this stuff with policing, in which there was this moment where could have gone so differently, where this sort of mercy was extended to me, partly because I think the police officer said, this is not dangerous, this person's not dangerous, I extend them the benefit of the doubt, this is going to be a hassle. And that benefit of the doubt, that moment, that judgment, that latitude that was granted me is so different than the way the system operates on so many other people.
So explain what a colony in a nation, where that comes from, and where we currently are in this nation,
yeah,
as far as our colony and our nation.
So Richard Nixon, 1968, gives a speech, a sort of famous law and order speech, the Miami Republican Convention, and he's talking about law and order. And at one point, he sort of says, and as a side, you know, he says, black people in this country want to be equal, and they don't want to be just sort of recipients of state aid. They don't want to be a colony in a nation. And I read that phrase as I was thinking of writing this book, and I had seen in Ferguson and seen in Baltimore a relationship between citizens and police that looked much more like the subjects of a colonizing or occupying army and their occupiers. And that phrase stuck in my head that what we have created in many respects is precisely a colony and nation. We've created a sort of compartmentalized part of American life in which the law functions on people the way that occupation does. And it's a kind of relationship that our founders themselves rebelled against when they fought the revolution.
And Donald Trump talks about himself as a law and order. Yeah, absolutely. Donald Trump talks about himself as a law and order candidate. This feels a lot more, you sort of draw the distinction between what law is and what order is and how he is far more order than law.
This is, to me, the key point, that when we hear that phrase law and order, they run together in our head, right? But the law is a complicated thing, and when people say, well, this unauthorized immigrant broke the law, my response to them always is, have you broken the law?
Mm-hmm.
Have you broken the law? And the answer to that question is yes. To everyone sitting in this room and everyone watching at home, the answer is yes. You've driven over the speed limit. You've gotten behind the wheel with one too many drinks. You've stolen a candy bar as a teenager. There are so many ways in which the way we enforce the law is dependent on how we think about the social order and who threatens it. And what law and order functionally does is it maintains a certain kind of social order. And we're seeing that. We saw that in the 40, 50 years we built the largest prison system in the world. And we're seeing that now under the Trump administration.
It's a fantastic book. The timing is perfect. Your previous book, I will say, The Twilight of the Elites, also incredibly well-timed. You're very good at this.
Well, it was a little too early, actually.
Yeah, it was too early. You wrote, it was like a prequel, like, yeah, 8 years, yeah, before it really, yeah, yeah, hit home. So thanks so much for being here, man. It's always
a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Chris Hayes, everybody, All In Airs weeknights on MSNBC. The Colony of Nations is in stores tomorrow.
35. I'm with Chris Hayes.
25 you, minutes to go.
25 minutes. You were on the air. You were on the air in 25 minutes.
Yeah.
What is usually, what is this time usually like for you?
Usually I'm editing my scripts right now in a software we call iNews.
Okay, we're in the elevator now going down to the fourth floor.
Yeah, so usually from basically 6:30 to 7:45, I have an hour 15 of scripts coming in.
Uh-huh.
I revise, I edit, I ask questions of segment producers. And by 7:45, I've hopefully starred all the scripts, which means I've read them, revised them, edited them. And then I go down to makeup.
Great.
Right now, I'm going to go try to read my whole show.
We're on the fourth floor now. We are running you down to your office. We're literally running you down to your office.
Running
right
out
now.
Of my office. What are we at? What time is it?
It's 7:36.
Okay.
Okay. How long are you in makeup?
Usually makeup's about 7 minutes. I try to head down around 7:45.
Uh-huh.
So right now we're 7:36. I'm already made up, although I have to put a tie on. But uh-huh. I can probably pound through all of the scripts in about, if they're in good shape, 12 minutes, and if they're not in good shape, I'm just hosed.
Have you gotten faster at tying a tie?
You know, want to hear my, like, hilarious secret?
On this podcast, yeah.
All my ties are pre-tied. They're all tied by me, but uh-huh. Leave them looped in a pre-knot,
uh-huh.
hanging, so I just
Great.
Grab them and just pull.
Awesome.
It's a little industry trick.
Yeah.
Not to take you too far behind the curtain. All right,
right. There you go. Have a good show.
See you guys.
Hi, I'm Steve Batista, and I am one of the stage managers for Late Night.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reese, and I am the audience warm-up comedian for Late Night with Seth Meyers.
And this is Late Night Chats with Steve and Ryan. Late Night Chats. All right, for those of you who don't know, once again, I'm Steve, and I'm here with Ryan Reese, our warm-up comedian for the show. And for anyone who hasn't been to a taping of Late Night, Ryan, why don't you explain to them what it is you do exactly?
Okay. I'm the warm-up comedian. It's my job to kind of loosen up the audience and get them prepared to laugh at jokes because the audience comes in probably, what, like an hour early? Hour and a half early?
Yeah,
and
roughly.
They're in holding. And
it is not
security.
An easy thing to do, Ryan, because people are – they know what the show is. But they don't. You have to come in and not only do comedy. You're a comedian, and you're used to doing comedy in clubs. But this is a very different gig than that. Yes.
Yeah. Well. There's a lot to it. But I mean, it's not a club gig. It's a lot more audience work than it would be material based. Because you have to engage the audience, kind of get them loosened up.
And you kind of have the bummer job of having to like state some what's would seem to some people be obvious rules and regulations for the studio and safety stuff, which could be a little awkward because you're there, they're there to laugh, and all of a sudden here's this guy who is ready to make them laugh. But first, here is some stuff you can and cannot do.
Yeah, I definitely open up with the rules, but they're not too bad. I wouldn't call it a bummer. It's just basic stuff, you know, like don't go on the internet during the show, like pay attention, kind of have fun. But Steve, you're the stage manager. You control everything.
Well, that's not exactly true, but there's two of us. There's myself and Tom Ustaferi. He's like the back of house stage manager, and I'm out front. So I'm with Seth, giving him his cues. I cue the band, the HE band, that is. And between the two of us, we just kind of help the director, Alex, down in the booth, execute the plans that the writers and the producers have put together and try not to biff it.
You're the link between everyone. This is just from what I've seen. I could be wrong here, but I think you're kind of like the link between like the director, sometimes the writers, the producers, and Seth, because you're cueing Seth.
Yeah, sure thing. And
me. Like
yeah,
you control all
yeah,
my
well,
cues too.
Well, here's the thing. This is how we work together during the show. You and I, where we come together, is we sort of are the cheerleaders. You know, there's obvious points where the audience know. You know, they laugh on their own, but there's certain parts of a TV show where they need to. We need to that applause to like open up or wrap up a segment. It's just something that happens in TV, and we have to like kind of sometimes let them know when that's happening. So that's where we would work together, but we're up there flapping our arms like crazy, making them go.
Oh, just like the cues if they don't see the applause sign is what you're referring to and whatnot,
right?
And stuff like that, I guess.
Now, we actually worked together on a show before this. We met, what would you say, 2010, 11, something like that?
Yes, I'd say 2011.
Yeah, we worked together on the Rachel Ray Show, the talk show. Not the Food Network show. Sure, why not?
On another network, a failing network. I don't know. I don't watch it.
Okay. anyway, I'll stay out of that one. Very different audience, wouldn't you say?
I'm sure our listeners know who Rachel Ray is. It was a cooking show. Yeah. It was a network show. Usually the audience for that was primarily mothers and daughters. I would say that was my impression of it. It would be like something that mothers and daughters would go do, and very New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Italian, Irish.
Yeah, and here we get all comers. I mean, it's really great. We get people from all over the world. I mean, we're in Rockefeller Plaza, so that doesn't hurt. But also people, you know, really varying ages, I'd say.
Well, I'd say 20% of our audience is international guests. I mean, they all speak English, but I mean, the show has a wider reach than certain other shows.
What would you say, Ryan, is the easiest part of your job?
The easiest part?
Yeah.
Thank you. Good night.
Yeah. Okay. When it's done. Okay. That's fair.
I think the biggest thing for doing a warm-up gig as opposed to a comedy club gig is in a comedy club, it's my show. So if I mess it up, it's on me. You know, if I say the wrong thing, if I do the wrong thing, it's all on me. Here, the warm-up is not about me. It's about Seth. It's about all the hard work that all the writers and the producers put into the show and having it be good for them. So I'm constantly under pressure of don't say or do the wrong thing that's going to, you know, negatively affect the anything that's about to come on after me. And I'm improvising. I'm trying to improv, so.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but if you've been to a comedy club, any of the big comedy clubs in New York City in the last, geez, a long time, they've probably seen you, whether you're hosting or doing a set.
Did a long time, huh? Did my walker give it away?
No, well, I've known you for at least, you know, 7 years, so. But I do have a confession to make. I've known you for way too long to have not been to an actual one of your sets. I've only seen you on our work gigs do comedy, and it's not fair, and I'm sorry for that. I apologize for that now.
You're forgiven.
Okay. So that means it's fine that I continue to not come see you?
I don't know. I got a feeling you're going to show up. I'm kind of fearful of anyone from work showing up at a comedy show because I think you guys would be like, I'm going to heckle.
No. Well, we don't heckle here, so why would I heckle there?
You don't heckle here.
I'm not that type of guy. You know that.
But yeah, I play the New York Comedy Club scene. New York Comedy Cellar. That's where you can find me.
And that is the place, let's face it.
Took a long time to get in there. Yeah. That was a bit of work. But Steve, how long have you been in network TV, man? I mean, like, I met you on a pretty high-profile show already. Like, you were already...
Yeah, well, I started a little early, but I've been doing television in general now for, I guess, going on 19 years. And I guess you could say I started doing a lot of music stuff. Like, I worked for MTV and VH1 and then moved on and... did a lot of food stuff, as the aforementioned Rachel Ray and some other shows and stuff. And now I'm doing all this comedy stuff. I've been very fortunate. I guess I started in 1998.
Right out of college?
Yeah. I did an internship and then got hired right out of my internship, fortunately.
So to the people listening, if you wanted to, like, because what did you major in college that, like, did stage
managing?
I was, like,
communications, and I did the television production thing, but I went to community college. I wound up...
give us the name. Which one?
I went to Brookdale Community College, the County College of Monmouth, New Jersey.
Fine institution.
Yes. And I got offered a job right out of there. I was going to go to a four-year school to get my bachelor's degree, but I was like, you know what? I'm going to take this job.
In television, that's also kind of a rarity. So, I mean, anyone who's around it knows that if you get that kind of shot, especially coming out of college, you take it immediately. You jump on it because those opportunities just don't come up, especially in production.
Yeah, absolutely. But it wasn't until, I mean, I've had a lot of great gigs, but what a big deal it was to have an opportunity in all the time that I have worked. And we work with people who have worked a lot longer than I have. But to have the opportunity finally to come work at 30 Rock, a place, you know, with all these amazing shows over the years and... to have the opportunity to work with Seth on this show, and we've come to get to know like Mike Shoemaker and all these people who have worked on other shows in the building, and now, hey, holy cow, we're working on one too, and it's turned out the last 3 years have been a lot of fun. Speaking of the last 3 years, what's been your favorite moment so far?
You actually make a really good point as a comedian to work, on a comedy show, number one, on a really dominant comedy show with such talented people, number two, is amazing. And then, you know, getting a chance to work in 30 Rock, like because of this show, I've had the opportunity actually to work in the SNL studio on a few projects.
And awesome.
So it never doesn't hit you. You never lose sight of where you are. You always understand, like, oh wow, the Tonight Show is below us. You know, SNL is down the hall. You know, Seth is 8 feet away behind a desk. I'm introducing Seth Meyers. How ridiculous is that?
It's pretty cool.
It's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah. I've paid more attention to what other people like are saying, like on Twitter and things like that about SNL and about Late Night and the Tonight Show and everything like that. And it's kind of weird to be part of it and be like, oh, they're talking about the people I work with and see on a regular basis. And it kind of, it's a really neat thing.
The evolution of the show. Sure. It went from a really funny comedy show to, in addition to being funny, it's actually got a big social and I don't know what you call it. You know, it's got more of an impact on the culture than just comedy.
Yeah, I'd say so. Never more telling than when we did a week's worth of shows in Washington, D.C. back in October,
yeah.
Where we had giant audiences compared to what we normally have. Obviously, we can only fit so many in the studio here at 30 Rock.
2,000, right?
Yeah, it was close to 2,000 people every night, and it was in D.C. with all the, you know, political humor that they tackle on our show, very knowledgeable audiences and just en masse, like so many of them. Being on that stage when the HE band would kick in and the audience would start. It literally was like a wave of applause that if you could feel it, it was insane. If I had to say, it was probably my favorite moment was that whole week that we got to go out there as a big family. I mean, we traveled like 160 something people there from New York, took over a hotel, which I don't know if anyone else that was staying in their hotel, if there was any other rooms available. I feel terrible because maybe they'll have to cut this out. But we took over that bar like every single night. Like there's plenty of bars in the D.C. area, I'm sure. Politicians like to drink, yeah. But we had a nice time. And I think we all like came together and put together a really nice week of shows.
Oh, I thought the stage looked great. Everything you guys did, it was really very impressive. I mean, it didn't even seem like an away show. It seemed like we had been there forever.
Yeah, it did feel sort of like a home crowd.
Yeah, well, no, it was crazy, man. Joe Biden was on the show.
Yep, he was on our very first show, and then he was on that week. It was very cool. I had actually a very cool Joe Biden moment. I had like my own little personal moment where he was on for two segments because his wife, Dr. Jill Biden, was on the second of the two acts. So Seth had to leave to, you know, see producers backstage and stuff like that. So I just went up so that he wasn't sitting by himself. And I just let him know, like a obvious staging, you know, direction. Say, oh, when your lovely wife comes out, if you could just slide over. And he just put his hand on my knee and he went, Steve, I always slide over for Jill. And he just looked me right in the eye. And I was just like, this guy's the best. I love him very much.
Vice President touched your knee, man.
Yeah, he did.
It's a big deal.
Yeah, I think my knee is officially part of the succession. Is that what they call it? Now I don't know how many people have to go away for my knee to become president, but
it's pretty crazy. That's that was definitely a highlight. You got a good point there. Where do you think the show's going to go next? Do you think we're doing any more away shows?
I think it'll be a while, but I really hope we get to do more away stuff.
What other famous people have touched your knee?
Listen, I've signed so many, you know, non-disclosure forms that I don't think we can get into that here. As far as traveling the show again, that would be a ton of fun. But there is something comforting about coming into 30 Rock, into our studio and onto our set, and just rocking and rolling and killing the show, and you know, we're in such a nice groove, I think, as far as the crew. Like, first of all, this is kind of, if I can say this, like a lot of the other people have done this podcast so far, these late night chats, you know, are people that are on the show. And I think we're maybe the first two people that aren't on the show. Like, although I have made a couple of appearances.
And not the ratings drop.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And not as many appearances as my partner, Tom, as you might know from Late Night B-Plots.
Oh, yeah. You've been on the show, actually, a couple of times. You've been on the show, actually.
I have, a few times.
Yeah, technically. Only half this power couple right here hasn't been on the show. Why don't you tell the audience what you did on the show?
Oh,
I think I can remember at least.
Well, I did Crew Poetry, which is a recurring sketch that they do on the show, which was very embarrassing, mainly because of the poem that they wrote for me.
That you were too handsome to be a stage manager?
Yeah.
He is very handsome. I can tell you during warm-up, people will ask if he's available or not.
Oh, boy. And I told you immediately to shut that down because it's humiliating. And I turn beet red. But anyway... we do have a great crew is what I was going to get to say. And I just want to give a shout out to all the people that we work with, like on the other side of the camera. We have great writers that perform on the show. Of course, we have Seth, our host, and everything like that. But there are a lot of people behind the scenes that work on the show, stage hands, you know, our camera operators, everybody. It's a lot of fun. It's a big, big, big fat family. And I think mostly everybody likes each other.
I mean, you put in the hours. You would know. You put a lot.
Oh yeah. Speaking of hours, like, you know, I should say once again. I'm Steve, the stage manager, and Ryan Reese, our warm up comedian. We started recording this at about 5 p.m. on Wednesday. We have a show in like an hour and a half, and I think we had to ask you to come in early for this, right? We usually roll in like right at what, 5:30?
No, usually, about 5:15. But I also. What do I do before this is what you're
Well,
about?
I just want to say, like, that's like,
sure.
That's a sweet gig.
Well, I'm also a contributing writer on the show. So during the day, I get emailed the setups.
Right. And you submit monologue jokes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think I'm up to 40.
Oh, great.
That I've gotten on air.
So very cool.
So that's what I would be.
Hey, late night TV monologue on, you know, getting your monologue jokes on a late night TV show. That's no small feat and must feel great as a comedian. Well, we're going to wrap this up because I feel like this might be the last one with the behind-the-scenes people because we've probably bored you to death. But if we haven't, we're glad you listened, and this has been fun. So thanks for chatting with me, Ryan.
Oh, yeah, Steve, it's always a pleasure to spend an afternoon and evening with you, and I look forward to traveling with your knee in the future.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Late Night Chats with Steve and Ryan.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
What came first, the chicken or the egg? Spoiler alert, it's neither. At Happy Egg, we believe happiness of the hens is what actually came first. Because without happy hens, there would be no such thing as happy eggs. You know, eggs with delicious orange yolks. Those come from hens who are raised the happy way on 8-plus acres of family-owned farms. Choose happy at happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.